Hello, my name is Sam Clements, and welcome to The Love of Cinema, a Picture House podcast. This is the monthly review show from Picture House Cinemas, covering a handful of the amazing films coming to the big screen near you in February. Now, we can't cover every film, there are far too many being released every single week, but what we're doing in this show is we're going to highlight a handful of the new releases, and we'll bring you a couple of special interviews also. As always, do check the Picture House website for full listings, picturehouses.com. Anyway, before we get into our film reviews, our four featured films for this podcast, I should introduce you to our guest film critics. Every month, as is our wont, we invite different film critics onto this show to talk about the films for us. This month, really pleased to be joined by Kathy Cullen and Tom Selinsky, two of my favourite film podcasters working today, making incredible shows. And yeah, I thought it'd be fun to bring them together like a mad puppet master to talk about the February releases. So to just go through some credentials, Kathy co-hosts a fantastic podcast called The Cinemile, where Kathy and her husband Dave walk home from the cinema and talk about whatever they've just watched. I love the format, I love the chemistry, I love the natural dialogue, and it's what we all do, right? We go to the cinema, we have a chat on the way home, and Kathy will be talking to Tom Selinsky, co-host of The Best Pick Pod, a fantastic format. Wish I'd thought of it myself. A podcast all about the films that won the Best Picture Award at the Oscars. There's 93 of those in real life. Then we have 93 podcasts from Tom and his co-hosts all about these films. So we've got Tom from the Best Pick Pod, got Kathy from The Cinemile. And I think if you enjoy what we do here on The Love of Cinema, you should definitely check out their shows. I've put all of the links in the show notes. Whilst looking in the show notes, don't forget to subscribe to the show, leave a rating or a review. It really helps others find this podcast. I think that's all of the admin. Thank you for bearing with us. We've airlifted these two fine podcasters out of their usual formats, and this month Tom and Kathy will guide us through some of the best new films coming to your local Picture House cinema. First up, Joanna Hogg's much-anticipated The Souvenir Part 2, follow-up to her 2019 film, The Souvenir, a film which stars Honor Swinton Byrne, Tilda Swinton, and Richard Ayoade. This film is in cinemas from the 4th of February. Special bonus treat for this next section. After Kathy and Tom's review, we'll go straight into my interview with the film star, Honor Swinton Byrne, who was recently in London to attend a special screening of the movie. And in these pandemic times, we record the podcast mostly remotely, but we are starting to record in person again. And Honor was actually my first in-person interview for about 18 months, which is really nice. It's so nice to do an interview and not have the lag of a Zoom screen. So yeah, an actual real life in-person interview after Tom and Kathy.
Patrick. Hi.
How's your film?
Good.
Did you avoid the temptation to be obvious?
I think so.
That's all you can hope for, isn't it?
1-1.
So, Tom, have you been waiting for The Souvenir Part 2, and did you enjoy it?
I have to confess, I wasn't waiting for The Souvenir Part 2. I'd, to my slight embarrassment, never heard of The Souvenir. And so when it was suggested that we go and see The Souvenir Part 2, I did ask, should I make sure I've seen The Souvenir first? I did watch The Souvenir first, and I'm extremely pleased that I did, because the first one knocked me flat. I couldn't believe I'd never seen this movie before. It's so detailed and so intricate. Honor Swinton Byrne is amazing, and so is Tom Burke. Part two is largely about Honor Swinton Byrne's character trying to pick up the pieces of her life and try to figure out what of the various stories that her boyfriend was telling turn out to be the truth and what are lies. And that's actually quite unresolved even at the end of this.
Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting film from my naive perspective of not having seen the first one, which I probably would have enjoyed more, as tends to be with sequels. But the fact that this movie is about grief, of course, but it's also a film about a film being made, which is just something I tend to enjoy. And kind of interestingly about a female filmmaker and how she struggles to get her voice heard. and to get respect. And that element is also very interesting. And I think, therefore, you don't need to have seen the first one to appreciate the filmmaking process as it's unfolding in front of you. It's such a beautiful movie. I really recommend seeing it in the cinema because it's, you know, it's gorgeous looking and really vivid in that sense. And she's just incredible. I had also heard of the original movie, of course, because she's Tilda Swinton's daughter. And seeing them on screen together as mother and daughter is just kind of a kick, isn't it? Like, it's just, if I Amazing. Didn't know what, I wouldn't have guessed it. I don't think they look that alike, but obviously they're wonderful on screen together.
But yeah, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Tilda Swinton's one of my favourite actors on screen. And her daughter, who basically made her film debut with The Souvenir, is astonishing. As someone once said, you can't catch her acting. She never seems to be telling you what to think.
It's interesting because it's an autobiographical movie for the director, and it feels like Honor is not actually acting. It feels like it could just be an autobiography about her. And I do really always find that interesting when you're watching something that you know is autobiographical, trying to figure out the difference between what really happened the director and what is like filled in for movie purposes. So that's quite a kick as well to enjoy. So yeah, overall, I'm a big fan of this movie. I think it's an interesting one that a sequel came from, The Souvenir Part 1. I don't think anyone would have been expecting. I presume it didn't have Part 1 at the end of the title. Like, it wasn't a Dune Part 1.
No.
So yeah, I think this is, I like to see a sequel coming out of something that's not a blockbuster. It's very unusual.
Yeah, and it's great just to spend a bit more time in this world with these characters and see some things that you don't often see. There's a scene early on with Honor Swinton-Byrne's character talking to her late boyfriend's parents. That's not a dynamic I think I've ever seen before, and it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. They have such different perspectives on the man who's no longer there. Absolutely, absolutely fascinating. And it reminded me of other movies about movie making. Do you remember, or did you get a chance to see the reconstructed Orson Welles film that was on Netflix a few years ago, The Other Side of the Wind?
No, I've meant to, and you've just reminded me. I need to.
Yeah. I think, unfortunately for me, one of the problems with The Other Side of the Wind is that a lot of it is Orson Welles parodying the sort of avant-garde films that were being made at the time. And one of the things he's keyed into is that often they could be quite boring. And he's faithfully replicated that, as well as all of the gratuitous female nudity. So the bits that aren't the film, I think, are more interesting. And I think the same is true here as well. I wasn't terribly interested in Julie's student film. I was much more interested in her and her attempts to get that film made than the film itself.
Yeah, I love the scene where she's explaining to her film school professors, these kind of faceless white men, about how she wants to make something creative and different and not something that was very much in vogue at the time, like a documentary style gritty film, and how dismissive they are of her and how she sticks to her guns. And I just found that really interesting, especially considering it's set in the 80s, which I don't think we've mentioned. It's like happening around the fall of the Berlin Wall. There's a lot going on. And then one of the last things I wanted to mention was how it deals with addiction and how subjective that is, depending on who saw the addict and what kind of state they have may or may not have been in. And that's really, you know, it's just really sad when you think about it, the impact of addiction on loved ones as well as the person who suffered themselves. And so there's a lot going on in this movie, and yet it manages to be a bit uplifting and, you know, a lovely watch.
Good morning, Honor. Thank you so much for joining us on the Picture House podcast today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This is the first in-person interview we've done on the podcast for so long, almost 2 years, a year and a half, which is wild.
Amazing. I feel very honoured.
So we're here today because The Souvenir Part 2 is in cinemas, where it should be seen, thank God. It's been a long time coming, this one.
It has. It's been a long time coming. This, yeah, the ending chapter, like the sort of climax has been reached, I feel. I'm really satisfied. I feel like I've finished a big meal now. I'm just so happy people can see it now. Yeah, a long time coming. It's been years. We've been working on this for, you know, 5 years.
Wow.
Like a long time.
When this first entered your life, The Souvenir Project, was it always going to be two films? Was that the plan with Joanna?
It was. From what I understand from Joanna, it was the plan from day one, I think, is that she wanted them to be shot back to back, ideally, to sort of like have continuity and the flow. And I think she wanted, I mean, I don't want to speak for her, but from what I understand, she wanted to sort of just get both over and, you know, over before she could hear criticism or people's insight between the two films, maybe put off her vision and be thrown off course. But I think from, I mean, I'm very grateful we stopped for 2 years between doing them, because it means I could do some growing as Honor and come back and sort of bring a different thing to Julie and have a good old mull over everything. And I think come back and, yeah, I'm really glad that it worked out that way. I think it was meant to be.
It's funny, isn't it? Because in the narrative of the film, it sort of carries on straight away. Mm. But then, you know, time sort of passes quite fluidly there. But yeah, for you as a real person, 2 years in between, a lot can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot happened. I went to Africa for a year. I was a volunteer teacher. So I think, I mean, I like to think I grew a backbone in those 2 years. I came back and I was an adult. So it was interesting, you know. I think the second one begins 2 days after the first one ends. So in those 2 days... in those 2 years for Honor, you know, it was like a lot changed for both me and Julie. So I think it was, yeah, it worked perfectly. I think it kind of aligned in a good way.
What was it like getting back into, after taking this break, you know, and you're not an actor, you know, by trade, you're not doing lots of other acting in between. So it's leaving Julie, having 2 years of life, coming back to Julie. What was it like just, you know, going back to the set, getting the costumes fitted, putting the makeup on?
I love all that. I just love it so much. It was so much easier than I expected it to be. I sort of came back on set and I was like, my God, I think I'm going to have to do a lot of sort of getting all that method, all that kind of like really like in all that actory stuff. But it really wasn't like that. I sort of had just a couple of conversations with Joanna being like, right, okay, so, you know, we're just going to remember what happened at the end of the last one. And I think in these 2 days, you know, maybe Julie went back to her parents. She's feeling she's going through the 7 stages of grief. She doesn't really want to handle the situation. She wants somebody to tell her what to do, which is, you know, what lots of people feel during grief. I feel like you want to surrender and just be told what to do and have somebody else look after you. And so we just talked about that very briefly, and then we were like, right, okay, let's do a take, let's try. And it just did kind of flow. I like to think it felt like it did. And yeah, the second one, there was a lot more kind of collaboration. I feel there was a lot more conversation, more kind of inclusion in with me in the story, in the future of Julie, and which I really liked. So it was kind of, I felt more included by choice.
That sounds fab. I guess great. Also you know a lot of the people better. You've gone through the experience of the first film. You've had those years, you've kept in touch. It must be a bit more, I guess, a lot of the sort of awkwardness that might be, you know, with starting a project goes out of the way because you're reteaming with people you already know.
That's such a good point. It really was like that. I feel like it was the real, you know, we went back and we were a family all together. And I said to somebody said, oh, you know, is it difficult coming back and trying to be the same person? I was like, well, Julie's not the same person. Like, she really is a different person, I feel. So it was easy for me to come back on her being a different person, to be like, right, okay, I'm not really playing the same character. I'm playing a grown-up version. So I think the real heroes are the people that had to come back and play the sort of pick up from where they left off in the first film and be a consistent sort of person that hasn't gone through a big life trauma. So that's a difficult thing after 2 years, I think, coming back and pretending that you're sort of really the same person that you were 2 days earlier. But yeah, so I had it easy, really.
I guess, yeah, Julie's got a really good excuse.
Yeah, exactly.
During that time, you know, were you getting updates to the script, or how much did you think about Souvenir Part 2 in the gap?
I thought about it quite a lot, but I didn't. It was so nice for me to look forward to it and be like, right, okay, so I'm going to do that next year, and I've got a plan. I've got like a plan for my next project, and that was cool. I thought about that while I was in Namibia. I was working quite hard doing a different kind of a different job, but I could be like, right, okay, I'm excited about continuing that saga, finishing it and polishing it off for people, and just, yeah, it kept me going. It really was the light at the end of the tunnel.
Did people, friends and people you bumped into go, what's going to happen? Part 2.
They did. Not as much as you would think, not as much as you would hope. I feel like a lot of, yeah, there were a few people that were like, what the, like, what's gonna happen? Like, where can you take it? And I was like, well, you'll see. And I was like, I don't really know, but
it's gonna be great.
I'm gonna discover as well. So like we'll discover together.
What were you sort of looking forward to doing the most when you were like, you're back on set with Julie?
I think just spending time with everybody on set. I think just spending time with Joanna, getting to know her even better, spending time with my mum, with my dogs, with Jagan, who plays Marlon, with Garance, and all these different characters, and meeting new ones as well. And also getting to know Julie, the new Julie. So I wanted to kind of just human connection. That's what I was craving. That's what I was excited about broadening. Yeah, that's what I was most excited about. And really seeing where Julie was going to end up, because I really didn't know. But yeah, Joanne and I, like, we say that we found out together. We really didn't know at the beginning of the film.
Kind of a, it sounds scary, but it also must be quite a fun way to go. It's like, we have to absolutely hit that mark. If we don't hit the mark, it's ruined.
It was frightening. But you know, it was so freeing. It was such a great way to work. It was such a, yeah, it was freeing. It was good. It was good for me. Really, really loved it, yeah.
Oh, nice. what's it like on a Joanna Hogg set, you know, out of when you're not shooting, you know, is there socializing or does everyone go back to their rooms and is studying the script?
Do you know what this, I mean, there was, I mean, from what I understand, there was no script. There was like, there was a manuscript. That's what they say. That's what they call it. So, and I've never seen either films. I've never seen the first one or the second one. So I wish I could tell you what it looks like. I like to think it's in a big like leather bound sort of, with a sort of holy grail above it. Like, I have no idea what goes on inside that manuscript. But I think maybe a few of the characters, definitely Tom in the first film and perhaps my mum in the second one, they were more sort of familiar with it and knew where the film, you know, knew what the sort of skeleton was. Mm. I chose not to read it in the second one because I really wanted to sort of have the organic sort of raw experience to it, like just the reaction to things rather than the sort of expectation. And yeah, no, it was so much socializing on set. Like, everybody was best pals. And I just really, I've never known any other experience. I've never had been an actor on a set before, so I don't really know how it usually is. I had, you know, I've had the experience of being with my mum on set, but never being a part of it. So I don't have much to compare it to, but it was proper. It was just lovely, sort of all the departments mixing. And it was just wonderful. It was just such a warm, very, very safe energy for me. I felt really happy. And yeah, it was really fun.
Feels like, as a viewer, you know, it's quite a close-knit cast, even though it's quite a big cast. Mm. There's some really good chemistry there. There's lots of scenes which are shot in quite enclosed spaces. A great scene on a minibus on the way back from a troubled day of shooting And there's so much going on. There's people all around you talking sort of over you. And Julie's really quiet in that scene. But that actually looked like, you know, you have to be quite tight to have eight people sort of all there in one location talking like that.
It's a proper dance. It really is. And it was kind of, you know, wasn't properly involved in sort of all the speaking. I just had to sit there and take it, which was like really quite tough. I feel like with the improvising, when someone's improvising being really angry at you, it's quite frightening. Or like, I don't know, like I'm actually quite upset. Like, I know I look upset, people think I'm acting, but I actually am actually quite frightened of all these people. That was an amazing kind of logistic, like everybody, that was very complicated kind of navigation around each other, but they did it so beautifully. Mm. And then I had Jagan, Marlon, Julie's best pal, next to me. Mm. And that was just fantastic because we're best pals in real life. So really defending me, and it was just, it was awesome. It felt really, it was fantastic. But it was so sweet when we cut. I remember Ben, the lovely cameraman at the back of the bus, would come and give me a hug and be like, I'm so sorry, it's coming. It's really not natural to me. It feels really weird. I promise I don't mean it. And then like the camera start rolling, he'd be screaming in my face. And it was just a laugh. It was really, yeah, it was like playing a game.
Sounds like a fun roller coaster.
It was emotional.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. And thank you for giving us this beautiful film. It was so nice to watch it last night. I can't wait to see it at the cinema again.
Thank you so much.
In coming weeks.
I really appreciate that. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, there we go. The Souvenir Part 2 is in cinemas now, and I do recommend seeing it on the big screen. It's a beautiful film. Moving on, we have the wonderful new film Flea from director Jonas Poe Rasmussen, an animated documentary feature in cinemas from the 11th of February. It's a truly unique way to tell this story. I mean, I guess in documentaries you do see experimental formats, but an animated documentary still feels like quite a rare bird. It sort of reminds me a little bit of Waltz with Bashir, which came out a few years ago now, but a really incredible film, just in terms of its approach to, you know, a serious, very realistic documentary subject, but then heightening it through this really emotive animation. And I think Flea does that too. That was my take, at least. But I'm fascinated to hear what Kathy and Tom thought about the movie.
The girl want nothing to be. Så det er min fortid, og det jeg kan ikke flygte fra det. Jeg har heller ikke lyst.
So, Kathy, next we have Flea, which is in that narrow intersection of genres, the animated documentary And as if that wasn't challenging enough, this is a Danish documentary about a refugee from Afghanistan. So there's lots of intersecting circles in the Venn diagram here. And this is not exactly blockbuster entertainment, but I was riveted all the way through.
I'm almost speechless about this movie. I'm so glad we watched it. I think it's only January, but it might be my best movie of the year. I found it fascinating because it's such a weighty subject matter. And honestly, you know, like a lot of us in the last couple of years, I've really struggled to watch any form of movie that deals with real life issues because I've just been dying for escapism. So I kind of came to it with a bit of a heavy heart, knowing the subject matter, and came away from it really blown away by how they can be touching on such weighty subjects about a real life refugee.
There's some really interesting stuff that comes out of the fact that it is animated.
Exactly.
Which I think was a decision they took principally to preserve the anonymity of Amin, who's telling his story. But it means that they can move very fluidly and very seamlessly from him telling his story to his Danish filmmaker friend, to the recollections that he has about his escape, to the recollections which are hazier, which are animated in a slightly different style. It all feels very much of a piece. And if they'd had to get actors in to recreate it, it would never have felt the same.
No, it would have been awful, actually. And what this movie captures so amazingly is like the present day. We know we're hearing from Amin, so we know he's okay, which is firstly something that really helps you watch the movie, I think. Then we're watching animations of his past, and some of it really traumatic and animated in kind of a different style. Some of it, and a lot of it, is actually happy memories of his childhood and growing up and experiencing moments like we all have. And I think it really serves to humanize refugees in an environment where we have them being dehumanized so often, particularly by the British government. And to see Amin is fleeing his country, and yet he's got a little crush on somebody and somebody's giving him a gift. And
yes, pictures of Chuck Norris on his wall.
Exactly. Like this, it's like, you know, all kids and teenagers have the same wants and desires, no matter what situation they're in. And this really captures when he's a young boy and he's gay and he hasn't come out yet and he's wearing his sister's dresses, and it's like this lovely scene of him running around in his sister's nightdress. And that is all then, of course, juxtaposed with some really dark elements of what happened to him and his family. But overall, it's an actual joy to watch a lot of it, and you spend so much of it wondering, because he's muddled it all in his head between fact and fiction, because he was, you know, a refugee telling their story is really difficult, and he's had to modify it depending on what authorities he speaks to. Sometimes you come away from, I came away from the movie thinking, oh, I still don't know the full story.
Yeah, it's really tapping into that thing that the stories that we tell ourselves can become almost a substitute for our memories. Like, do I remember this, or do I just remember how the story goes?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bit where, this isn't really a spoiler, but he's been given a cover story, none of which is true, but which will get him the asylum that he seeks if he can remember it correctly, as well as protecting the people who helped him. And the story is so traumatic that telling this made-up story moves him to tears.
Mm-hmm.
It's so moving. It's so powerful. But at the same time, there's a kind of playfulness about it. You know, they animate him getting into position in front of the camera and the clapperboard. It sort of reminds me of all things. It reminds me of those outtakes you used to see at the end of Pixar films.
It does, actually. And then you also get to see his coming out story as a gay man who was from Afghanistan, is now living in as a refugee, trying to hide his identity. And how, what does that do to your mind if you're trying to hide both your sexuality and your identity and your family story, and what that means for you as an adult who's always been so secretive? How do you open up? And it's fascinating. And I love the way they film the present, which is like a therapy scene almost, with him lying on a particular rug. And of course, I'm not sure if we mentioned, but he's very close friends with the filmmaker, or they seem to have a very good relationship. So you feel like you're kind of listening in on two friends talking sometimes. And I think he wouldn't have been as honest with another filmmaker. I don't think this project could have happened.
So that's Flea. Now, moving on, a film released on the same date, also on February 11th. You're spoiled for choice on February the 11th at the cinema this month. We are treated to another film from writer and director Ryosuke Hamaguchi, who has recently written and directed a fantastic film called Drive My Car. That was released in November, and we covered it on our episode that we released that month with Kalichi and Katie. Ryosuke Hamaguchi is an incredibly prolific director, and his filmography is made up of all of these really fascinating films. He's made a 5.5 hour long film. He's made short films. He's made hour long films. And in 2019, he was working on two projects side by side. One of them was Drive My Car, which we have seen. It's been in cinemas. It's still actually in some cinemas because it's getting some really great awards traction, and it's been picking up a few sort of big awards leading up to the BAFTAs and the Oscars. I'm definitely rooting for that. I loved it. But whilst he was working on Drive My Car, he was also working on a film called The Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, which is in cinemas this month. And it's an anthology movie, so it contains three individual films all sort of wrapped up in this familiar concept. And yeah, I actually did an interview with him recently because we're going to be doing a recorded Q&A after some of our screenings of this movie at Picture House, and he revealed that his next film is a follow-up to this. It's carrying on. He's got seven stories planned as part of Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. This film is the first three, and his next movie is going to be the remaining four that he's come up with. So, yeah, I'm interested to see what he does in that space. Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We haven't even talked about the first film yet. So, yeah, I was excited to show Kathy and Tom Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy and get their thoughts on the movie.
And then the next film we wanted to talk about was a Japanese movie that did very well in the film festival circuit last year, The Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy. Tom, what were your thoughts on this one?
So I knew nothing about this. When this was suggested, it was sold to me as, it's from the guy who did Drive My Car, which I'd never heard of. So I didn't know what to expect from this either. And it's in a subdivision of genres. It's Japanese, it's an anthology film, so you get three unrelated stories, but right from the very beginning, I was absolutely captivated by this. This writer-director favours long conversation scenes. It's very much like Tarantino in that way. He's very happy just to have two people, as in the first story, sit in the back of a taxi and just talk. And what they're talking about and the subtle shifts in their relationship as they talk are what the story is largely about. But this also has got that short story, that kind of Roald Dahl, O. Henry plotting, where there is always a twist, there's always something which you're not expecting, there's always a little unexpected detail. So it does require a certain amount of patience, I would say. But this was, for me, incredibly rewarding and absolutely fascinating to see these stories in this culture told in this way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we have quite different reactions to this one. I too knew nothing about it and hadn't seen Drive My Car, so we both have terrible knowledge of the previous works of these filmmakers. But I love the idea of an anthology series, three separate stories with female protagonists. I was all on board with that. What I found interesting is that I love when the focus is so small. It's just little incidences in these characters' lives. It's very mundane settings in terms of the visuals. Could have been shot really anywhere. I didn't necessarily get a sense that it was Japanese. Often, you know, an office building or the back of a car, like you mentioned, which is an interesting choice. However, for me, I wasn't compelled really by any of the stories. And I think this just comes down to a matter of taste and interest. I found the so-called twists a little bit obvious, I would say, in the first one in particular. I thought probably the last story was the most interesting one to me. I admire him because they're basically three completely separate stories that don't overlap, and it's been called a movie. And I love that playing with the form and, you know, what is a movie? A movie can be whatever you want it to be. And it's 2 hours long. They're quite meaty conversations. So there's a lot going for it in that sense. It's interesting. I just, unfortunately, the individual stories didn't particularly compel me.
And there's isn't a lot else to say about that. This will work for you or it won't. But these were three setups, certainly, that I'd never seen before. And I don't want to say too much about it because, as I say, there are kind of twist endings to a certain extent. But the three key scenarios, the conversation in the middle of the first film was one I'd never seen before. The conversation it's not really a conversation, but the reasons why a woman is reading an author a long section of his own novel. is something I've never seen before. And maybe I'll just give one thing away just in order to kind of lure people in a little bit. The third story revolves around a chance meeting between two people who went to school together. And it's only after one has gone back to the other one's house for tea that they work out between them they've actually never met before. And the whole thing's been a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm. That was the most compelling one, I think, and probably the most visually attractive setting as well. It's an interesting one, and for sure worth, I think it's worth a watch. And I know he's a very acclaimed filmmaker, and I do want to watch more of his work because it's been so acclaimed. It's a really subjective film, which I think is unique.
There's a weird thing in the third one as well, and in order to kind of paper over some plot holes. So many filmmakers have had perfectly good plots ruined by the ubiquity of smartphones and so on. And so at the beginning of the third one, there's just this caption which explains that there was a computer virus and all of that technology is just gone.
I enjoyed that.
Every so often people say to each other, how was the virus for you? Any effect to the virus? It's like, can we please just stop talking about viruses for once?
Yeah, it was a good idea, though. Just completely get rid of them. It's fine. But yeah, never mention the virus. Thank you very much.
So that's Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy, an incredible anthology story about chance meetings, beautifully realised by one of the best filmmakers working today. This is a fascinating film and in cinemas from February 11th. Speaking of great Japanese cinema and Japanese filmmakers, there's a new film in cinemas right now from anime author Mamoru Hosoda, the director of iconic Japanese animations such as The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, Summer Wars, and most recently, Mirai. Well, he's back with his most ambitious film to date. We don't have a full review of this, but just to set up this next section, I adored this film. It's such a rich visual experience. Definitely need to watch it on a big screen because there's all sorts of bells and whistles being played with at times to heighten the story. It's about a girl who goes into a virtual reality, and when she's plugged into the virtual reality, the spectacle is huge. It's a fantastically detailed film. Director Mamoru Hosoda actually came to Pitch House Cinemas in person last year, in November, I think, Pitch House Central, for an in-person Q&A, which is a fantastic treat, especially, in these times where travel is so restricted. So it's great to welcome him to the building. And whilst he was in the building, we sent previous podcast guest critic Katie Smith-Wong along to interview him. So without further ado, Katie will be talking to Mamoru Hosoda, who will be speaking to Katie in Japanese. So what you'll hear on the podcast is a translation of his answers in English over the top of his original Japanese answers.
I would like to talk about Belle. It's a beautiful, beautiful film. Some of the more obvious inspirations of the film is obviously Beauty and the Beast, which has been remade a lot of times, more famously by Disney. I just wanted to ask, were you a fan of the film or the original tale?
I found the story of Beauty and the Beast interesting as a child. The way that it overturns our values, that what we thought was beautiful is actually ugly, and what we thought was ugly turns out to be beautiful. I first saw the Jean Cocteau film as a student, and then after I graduated, I started working in animation, and it was really hard, really tough, and I was thinking about giving up. That was in 1991, and then Disney released their version of Beauty and the Beast, and it was amazing, and I thought, if this is what animation can do, maybe I'll keep going a bit. It was a really important film for me in that sense, and 30 years on, I've made my own version.
And it's a beautiful version, I have to say. I wanted to ask about the protagonist, Suzu, or Belle. They're two very different characters, yet they are the same person. How did you find the balance between the kind of qualities that each variant or each version of this person represented?
I've always thought that
there are lots of girls like Suzu, sitting in the corner of the classroom reading a book, and you might look at her and see a quiet girl, quite a gloomy girl, and think that that's all there is to her. But I've always wondered if that's actually the case. I think that there's another self waiting within all of us. Making Belle, that was what I was thinking. Everyone has different sides to them. If I look at my 5-year-old daughter, for example, at home, she's a complete princess. She does whatever she likes.
But at nursery, she's really shy and quiet, and she has one friend. And even at 5 years old, I can already see these two different sides to her. And we all have not just two sides, we all have multiple sides to our personalities. And I think about her and as she grows up, how all these different sides to her character are going to be drawn out by different people, and that she might turn into a different person.
Aside from the incorporating the fairy tale of Beauty and the Beast, some of the things that Belle actually addresses includes social media and online privacy being quite such a big narrative element. What was your inspiration behind this, or why did you go into this direction?
One of the big things about the internet is anonymity. You don't know who says what, and people can hurt others without any repercussions. And that's why trolling is such a big problem. So I did want Belle to be about that as well. And on the other hand, anonymity can also give you courage, because you can be someone else, another version of yourself, because no one knows who you are. But then what happens when people find out who you are? For people who want to be anonymous, being discovered, their real identity being discovered is a terrifying thing, and it's almost like internet death. So I wanted to look at what would it take for someone to be willing to make that sacrifice.
What were the key obstacles in your narrative? For instance, what kind of things did you want to address that posed a potential problem?
I did try to feature as many of these internet-related problems as I could. For example, the character of Justin, you know, his very name suggests justice, and he goes around with his own idea of justice and what's right. And this goes back to trolling and to destroying reputations online, because the people who do that, they don't think they're doing anything wrong. They think they're doing it for the good of society, protect people, because everyone has their own sense of justice. And online as well, everyone has their own sense of justice. And rather than talking to each other and coming to a conclusion about what is right, they all exist alongside each other. So Justin thinks that he's doing the right thing. He doesn't realize that he's hurting people, and he doesn't realize that he's seen as the bad guy. I think a lot of the issues and the problems that we face as humanity really come to light in the online world, and I did want to get as many of those across as I could.
As it is a collaborative project, I just wanted to quickly ask about what was the experience working with Jin Kim and Cartoon Saloon, who both of whom have had quite prolific works in their filmography.
The world of You is a global online world, so I wanted to work with people from around the world, the right people to make it. And that was partly possible because of the pandemic. It made it easier to work with people outside of Japan online, and in fact, it made it normal to do that. So that was one big reason why it was possible. I think without the pandemic, I would have had to actually go and see people face-to-face, and that's quite time-consuming, and so I might have ended up just sticking to Japan. But now it's possible to work with people around the world, and I think that's one of the good things that's come out of the pandemic. I tend to impose limits on myself and restrict myself, but this film showed me that it's possible to do more and to have more freedom. It's about a girl who is oppressed, you know, she's coming from a position of weakness, and it's about how she finds her freedom. And it was a bit like that for me with this film. It taught me that I don't have to just stick to Japan, that I can be free and that I can do something much bigger. So it's very important in that sense.
Thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much.
Domo arigato.
Domo arigato.
So that's Belle, and thank you so much to Katie for speaking to Mamoru Hosoda for us. The film is in cinemas now. And so, back to Kathy and Tom, who will review our final film for this month's podcast, The Duke, Roger Michel's final film. Roger Michel, the incredible director, made so many wonderful films, including Notting Hill, Enduring Love, Venus, My Cousin Rachel. Sadly passed away last year before the film got its theatrical release, but it's a wonderful film to be left with to remember him by.
and you know, like his other films, it's got all of his director trademarks in, very well realized characters, and a really human story. I think that's what he was so good at doing. This film is based on a fascinating true story. Yeah, I'm excited to hear what Tom and Kathy made of the film.
Will the defendant please stand? Kempton Bunton, you were charged that on the 21st of March 1961, you stole from the National Gallery a priceless portrait of the Duke of Wellington by Francisco Jose de Goya.
All right, and we finish our journey with the Duke, which is certainly of these four, I would say, the most accessible, the least challenging. It's a British comedy in the style of something like Brasdoff or The Full Monty. Directed by Roger Michell, who directed Notting Hill. And it's the true story of the theft of a painting by Goya by one Kempton Bunton, who was doing it to make a protest about a TV license. I can only assume that Nadine Dorries saw an early release of this. I was inspired by this stand taken in the early 1960s.
Yeah, it's a funny movie. It's definitely one because it stars Jim Broadbent and Helen Mirren. It's one to like... What I really like about it is it's clearly aimed at an older audience, and that is an audience that is completely underserved by cinema and tends to be much more served by TV, which is great because we've got so many prestige TV dramas. But I do find, like, when you look at box office figures, that they are always declining for that audience and they aren't served. And then when a movie comes out, like Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, it can smash it in the box office because there's such a desire in that audience. And I think this is in that vein. You know, I wouldn't say it's as probably fun as that movie, but it is up there. It's a heist movie about a British man in the 60s who robbed a painting because he wanted to get the government to pay for the TV license for OAPs. It's such a lovely premise. And yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I would say, like, get your mom, get your granny out to the matinee and watch it with them. It's definitely one to go to in the cinema, I think, because it's great fun. And, you know, it's just a treat to see a movie set in a northern part of England as well, which we don't always get to see. And Jim Broadbent's brilliant. So yeah, I've nothing but good things to say about it. And you're right, it's just really accessible, nice story.
Lovely evocation of period and place. It really feels like you're in the places you're supposed to be. Lots of little details which just make it sing. I love in particular, I don't know if this is true or made up, but when he isn't lifting paintings from the National Gallery, Kempton Bunton is sending plays into the BBC, one of which is called The Adventures of Susan Christ. So he evidently fantasizes that he's some sort of Dennis Potter-like figure. It also reminded me of Adrian Mole sending in his dreadful poetry to BBC Radio 4.
Oh, that's so funny. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, no, it does have that feeling. And he is also dealing with grief in this movie and trying to reconcile grief through some of his writings. And I did say, when I initially saw Helen Mirren as a cleaner, I didn't believe it. But then, look, she can sell me on anything. Fine, I believe that Helen Mirren can be a cleaner. it's interesting also, I love hearing actors like trying to do the Northern accent. I'm not an expert, but I thought there was a few slips. I don't know what you guys thought.
I didn't spot that, I have to say. I thought it was all pretty good.
It's a lovely movie, though, honestly, yeah.
It's written by Richard Bean, who wrote One Man, Two Governors, as well as Clive Coleman, who's a barrister, as well as a writer. And they've dug up a lot of stuff. I think Kempton Bunton's story was largely forgotten. In the early 1960s, it was a cause celebre. They see this in the movie, that the Goya painting that was stolen, which was actually missing for 4 or 5 years, they've compressed the timeline a bit here, was shown as being in Dr. No's lair in the first James Bond film. So set designer Ken Adam had to paint his own version of it to use as a prop. It was incredibly famous. And then he was kind of forgotten about. And when he died, there was no obituary of Kempton Bunton. So these filmmakers have gone back into this story and really dug up all these details, including the grief that they feel. That's apparently all true and all stuff that they found out, which had been just completely overlooked.
That's interesting. And I do think watching him fight against the, you know, the man and try and fight for the rights of him and the other OAPs, it's really admirable. And he's just such a lovely character. And the fact that you've got, it's a heist movie, it's a courtroom movie, and it's like a family drama all wrapped up in one, is just, yeah, perfect movie to go and see on a Sunday afternoon.
So that's The Duke, which opens in cinemas on the 25th of Feb. Now, whilst we had Kathy and Tom, two committed film fans, we wanted to ask them what they'd recommend seeking out in cinemas right now, films which may have carried over from Christmas or January. What would they recommend? And also what they're most looking forward to opening cinemas later in the year.
Kathy, anything still at the cinema which you've seen which you think people should rush out and see before it goes?
Do you know what I recommend is The Matrix Resurrections, because it's been a bit polarizing. It's a film that a lot of people were kind of looking forward to seeing because I know people are very much afraid of Matrix sequels. But I think it was a good movie. I enjoyed it a lot more than I was expecting to. And I had a lot of fun with watching those characters on screen again and seeing how the filmmaker brought it into today's world and made it relevant. And actually, I think she did a brilliant job. So I had a lot of fun with it. And if you're a Matrix fan, I think you might like it. You might surprise yourself. Don't be afraid.
And I think if you're going to go and see it on the big screen. Don't wait for it to come on streaming.
It's one to see in the cinema, absolutely. And Tom, what about you?
Did you get a chance to see the new West Side Story?
I didn't, no, but I'd love to. I just haven't caught it yet. So is this what you're recommending?
This is recommended again with some reservations, but I think it's one to see on the big screen because it's partly about how Spielberg's taken this story and just given it a completely new feel. Like, there's lots of things I really love about the 1961 Robert Wise, Jerome Robbins version, but I also can see lots of compromises. And for better or for worse, this is one filmmaker or one filmmaking team's singular vision of how to put this story on screen. And there are decisions I would quibble with, but I think there are some fantastic performances. The scope of it is something which really pops when you see it on a big screen.
Okay, I need to get to that one.
Anything coming up, Kathy, that you're looking forward to?
Do you know what I'm really excited about? It's a bit of a guilty pleasure of mine, but I do love Top Gun, despite all its flaws when I rewatch it. It evokes happy memories. And the fact that Top Gun Maverick is finally coming out this year, we've been hearing about it for so long. It's coming out this May. I'm hoping it would be great fun. It's clearly a movie to see in the cinema and on the big screen. And I'm hoping it's just a bit of event cinema, you know, with the kind of crowd that when you go to a movie like this, who are pumped and ready to have some fun and laugh in the audience and enjoy it. And I think I want to see it with a crowd. I want to see it on a big screen. So I'm going to be there opening weekend for sure, catching it. And what about you, Tom?
Well, from a movie that everyone's heard of to a movie I suspect almost no one will have heard of, but I do have a personal stake in it because it was written and directed by two friends of mine. So hopefully coming to a screen near you sometime this year is Summoning Sylvia, written and directed by Wesley Taylor and Alex Wise, who...
Great title.
Yeah, if you're in the habit of watching web series, you may have seen their show Indoor Boys. Summoning Sylvia is about the goings-on at a gay bachelor party, which takes a spooky turn when someone gets out a Ouija board. But it's also about what happens when a straight man turns up at this event. It's got a little bit of a sort of Get Out vibe. But instead of being a black guy at a wealthy white family, it's a straight man at an exclusively gay bachelor party. It's a ton of fun. I thought it was tremendous.
Oh, great. And I love an Ouija board plot as well. So I'll definitely be watching that one.
Kathy, where can people who've been dazzled by your insight find out more of what you've got to say?
Well, you can find me at The Cinemile, which is a podcast where my husband and I record our walk home from the movies. Wherever you listen to podcasts, check us out. And we tend to go and see the latest blockbusters and we'll just chat about them on our walk home from the movie. And we have a lot of fun with it. So find us over there, wherever you are on social media.
And if you've been dazzled by my insight, then you can listen to me, John Dorney and Jessica Regan talking. Originally, it was about Oscar Best Picture winners on our podcast Best Pick, but having exhausted all 93 of those, we're now broadening our remit and looking at films, some famous, some obscure, some old, some new. So join us there at bestpickpod.com. And if, despite all evidence to the contrary, listening to podcasts isn't your thing, you can also read everything we have to say about Best Picture winners in our book, Best Pick, A Journey Through Film History and the Academy Awards, which is out on the 15th of February and is available in, as they say, all good and evil bookshops.
That brings us to the end of our February podcast. Thank you so much to Kathy Curlin and Tom Selinsky for guest hosting, and to Katie Smith-Wong, returning guest critic, for interviewing the great Mamoru Hosoda about Belle for us. And I want to say a big thank you to Honor Swinton-Byrne for stopping by and being my first in-person interview in 2022. I mean, realistically, in the last 18 months, but it was so nice to do that interview and to talk to Anna Swinton Byrne, who is so good in The Souvenir Part 2, which is in cinemas right now. One final thank you, of course. Thank you! You, the listener, for listening. Whatever you end up watching at the cinema this month, I hope you enjoy, and please do share this podcast with your friends. Tell your friends, share us on your social medias, and do leave us that rating on Apple Podcasts. Every review really helps. If you do make it to the cinema, let us know what you watch. You can find us on Twitter at Picturehouses. We're also on Facebook and Instagram under the same handle. It's always exciting to hear what people are seeing. I love photos of cinema tickets. Tell us what you're watching. Send us a picture of your cinema ticket. If you have any questions about the podcast, you can email us at podcast@picturehouses.co.uk. The show was produced by Kobe Omonoka at Stripped Media and edited by the great Maddie Searle. I've been Sam Clements, and have a fabulous February. Hopefully you get to watch some films. Keep an eye on the feed. We'll be dropping a few shorter pods throughout the month. Sometimes we do special interviews with filmmakers or actors or someone related to a movie who might be in town and up for a chat. So do subscribe. We'll be dropping those throughout the month. And then our next full episode will be our March review episode, which will include a review of The Batman. So yeah, I'm excited. Sign me up. Can't wait for that one. And we'll be joined by some brand new guest critics to talk about that with us. That's enough from me. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great February. See you soon. Goodbye.